You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm your host, Abby, and today I've got a recording of another event at one of our branches. This event took place on Friday, October 26th at the Northside Library. It's a recording of local author Susie McKenna discussing her latest thriller, Lost Tracks. So I think you'll really enjoy hearing from her. But before we get into that, start with book chat. Okay, so I think we both read the same book this time.
Yeah, because it's short.
Yes. It's under 100 pages.
It's a really quick read.
So the book that we're talking about
is I'm Afraid of Men
by Vivek Shreya. And she is a trans woman artist of a variety of media.
Yeah, I didn't realize what the book was when I picked it up. Mm-hmm. I realized it was going to be a feminist event, and I thought it was going to be strictly from a woman's perspective.
Yes. So she is a trans woman who came out as an adult. And she starts by talking about how as a child she was living as a young boy, and because the boys around her were so vicious, I guess, she had to like tamp down any sort of femininity, anything that made her different, and tried to really work on this very masculine presence.
And she went so far as like to be trained by a straight male.
Yes.
On like how to walk and how to talk and...
And so she's writing, the first half she's writing to all of the people who influenced her, so sort of like to those boys who kind of terrorized her when she was younger, to the man who helped teach her to mm-hmm. appear more masculine, to all of the people who caused her to, who impacted her own shaping of her gender identity, I guess, or just her identity generally. And then the second half,
sorry,
she's talking more about herself, right, and what she...
Yeah, and the second half is also, like, where she found positive influences, right. So she could see gay men who felt comfortable mm-hmm. living in their skin and expressing themselves however they saw fit, mm-hmm. and that's when she started performing as a woman.
Right.
And joining things like pride parades and really finding community that felt more welcoming to her.
Right. So she was kind of exploring a different kind of gender performance, I think, until she was able to come to terms with herself as a trans woman and able to come out that way.
She also has a really interesting relationship stories because, you know, as a man who was trying to be as straight as possible,
right,
she ended up marrying a woman mm-hmm. and lived in that relationship for quite a period of time. And so it's also about how to find the relationships you are actually seeking and not the ones you think you're supposed to have. So that process was very interesting.
Yeah.
And sad.
Right.
It's always sad when there's not a happy ending.
Right.
Yeah, it was really good.
But it I feel like it was more of like a empowering read than really a like a bummer.
Oh yeah, totally. And she's not, I mean, as much as her relationships might not have turned out the way she expected, they seem to still be involved in her life.
Right. Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really interesting. I had to pick it up because one of the podcasts that I listened to was like, this podcast is sponsored by this book. It's like, well, I've heard the name of this book so many times that I have to read it now.
And also the front cover says the title, I'm Afraid of Men.
And the back says, and men are afraid of me. I think that's true, right? Like, that's what most transphobia and violence comes from, is this, like, fear of...
other.
Right. Fear of the other and what it means about you.
Contamination, almost, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah, but it was really good.
Yeah, she packed a lot into the tiny book.
Yeah.
Did you know about her before?
I didn't, okay. No. So, yeah, so she's, like, a performance artist, a musician, mm-hmm. A writer. She's all over the map and very prolific, it looks like.
Yes.
Okay, so completely changing the topic. The other book that I've just started, I'm only really getting into it, is called We Sold Our Souls by Grady Hendrix. And so this is fiction. It's horror, but it's like a campy horror. It's by this author who I keep reading, even though every time I read it, I'm like, I don't know if I enjoy this, but I get through to the end, and then I feel compelled to read his other work. So he also wrote Horror Store.
Oh, yeah.
Right, which is like a campy horror that takes place.
Not
sort
something
of,
I've read.
Right, sort of within the pages of an IKEA catalog, but also in it's not really IKEA, it's like an IKEA knockoff, but also within the store. And then he also has a book called My Best Friend's Exorcism, which takes place in like the 80s, and it's also sort of set in between the pages of a high school yearbook. So he always plays with format. Although this one, he did not play with format so much. This, as you may guess by the title, has to do with metal, like metal music, but like 90s metal music.
Is that
music.
What drew you in?
Well, it did, because the cover is just so absurd. There's like somebody playing guitar, and then all the pages are edged in black, and like it just looks ridiculous. And I open it, and every chapter is titled like the name of...
A song?
Yeah, the name of a song.
An actual song?
Yeah. Let me see if I can find a list. But they're all, like, things you might expect, like, Highway to Hell. Like, so it's basically just an AC/DC track listing, right? Like, all of them are... they're all over
the
map.
Yeah, if you were going to pick a band that was going to be a horror story.
Anyway, so there's this... So it's told from the perspective of someone who had formed the heavy metal band Dirtwork, which, of course, is spelled with U's and umlauts over the U's. And they were, like, big in the 90s, and then they fell apart.
Is this based on a real band?
No. But the rest of her band has sort of, like, excommunicated her. But then she sees one of the band members who, from how far in I am, seems to have, like, kind of... gone solo at the expense of the rest of the band. He's making a big comeback because she sees a big billboard with his character, who I think is called the Iron Knight. I can't actually remember what he's called now. Who is called...
That's so great.
Well, his band is called Coffin, with a K, obviously.
So on point.
He's something like... The Iron Knight? I don't remember what it's called. Okay. Obviously, I'm not reading that closely. She's really worried about it, and so she goes, she's, like, trying to find the other band members and be like, we have to do something about this. She comes across her first former bandmate, who she was closest to. They've been friends since they were, like, kids, but she hasn't seen him in, like, a decade. And he has, like, all these conspiracy theories, and it's not going well. And so then she's, like, trying to find all of her other former bandmates. And that's where I am. I don't know what's going to happen, but it promises to be a lot of campy horror, because it always is.
That's a very interesting premise.
Yes. And this was, you know, we were...
What an interesting author.
He's a weird guy, I would assume. All of his books, yeah.
They're so specifically weird.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, he has...
He picks up on one idea, and he's just like, I'm going to go for it with this one. And, like, they're campy, but they're also sometimes gross. Like, he's just got that gross detail...
He's just
more,
like...
gross than terrifying. Next up, we've got local author Susie McKenna discussing her latest book.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Northside Library. This afternoon's program is being audio recorded for the JMRL podcast on the same page, which is accessible through jmrl.org. So you can hear a recording of this program and dozens of other programs we've had all across the JMRL branches with different speakers and presenters. That's jmrl.org. Just click on the same page icon. We are delighted to have with us today local author and Mystery Club regular Susie McKenna, here to discuss her latest and highly acclaimed thriller, Last Tracks. Held by Kirkus Review as an enthralling, outdoorsy tale of one woman's extended hunt for a would-be killer, Susie McKenna, Midwest native and former software entrepreneur, has written an enthralling debut novel, sure to leave the reader asking for more. Books will be available for purchase at the conclusion of this program. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Susie McKenna.
Thank you. Let me start by saying that I think a lot of people here like to read thrillers and mysteries, and I do too. I come regularly to the library's mystery and thriller group that meets the fourth Tuesday of every month, and we read really good books in that group. So if you like to read thrillers and mysteries, please come. It lasts an hour. Marcia Mitchell is our leader. I call her the Sergeant Major because she makes sure everybody gets a chance to talk and no one controls the conversation. So it's really a good book group. Now, on to Last Tracks. I call it a feel-good thriller. Some of the books that are out today are so brutal that they become too dark, and I don't really enjoy them. I like a little bit of humor. So, yes, people do get killed, but I tell people it's dead bodies with humor. Now, Last Tracks, in the story, we do a lot of traveling. It starts with a young couple who are taking a supposedly romantic snowshoeing trip out west. So that brings us way out here to Jasper, Alberta. The story then comes back to Virginia, which is slightly off its way down here, and then it ends up back, it comes out to the Midwest, and then it comes back to Virginia and then back up into Canada again. So they do quite a bit of traveling on this trip. So we'll start, the story starts in, as they arrive in Alberta and they're on their way up to the resort where they're going to go on a snowshoe trip. The car crawled along a road that was supposed to be a highway. It looked more like a snow-packed country trail than a paved road. The few clear spots evidenced that a snowplow had cleared it at one point. Wind had blown snow back onto the road, making it difficult to keep the wheels and tracks left by other vehicles. The passenger, a woman, gripped the armrest with one hand and pressed the other hand into the dashboard, ready to keep herself from going through the windshield if the car slid off the road. The woman didn't move her eyes from the road. Her feet were ready to hit the non-existent brakes in front of her. But she didn't risk telling the driver, her husband, what to do in the treacherous driving conditions. Their rental car had front-wheel drive, snow tires, and an indicator on the dashboard that lit up when the tires lost traction. Andy Harris entertained himself by getting the indicator to light up, easy to do on an unplowed, slippery road. His wife, Deanna, was mildly amused only the first time the car lost traction and they spun and slid across the road. Andy had laughed and whooped like he was on a thrill ride at a water park. He prided himself on his ability to drive in winter conditions and made fun of the reaction to snow back in their home state of Virginia. At the first sign of even a light snow, there would be a run on milk and bread at the stores. Schools would announce closings and delays. Driving through Jasper National Park, even Andy was now tense and focused. So, we take a look here. Here's a map of just Jasper National Park. I think it's the largest national park area-wise in the Rockies. And it's true wilderness. We go up onto Skyline Drive and we think we're in the woods, but it really is nothing like being out here where you can go for hours and not see a gas station or a car. You can hike on trails for hours and not see another human being, as opposed to on the East Coast, we sometimes have to get a pass just to go up and hike some of the trails that have become really popular. The most common question I get is, how did you get the idea for writing the book? Well, I snowshoed for years, and my husband and I went out west to Jasper to snowshoe. We drive down this road that had snow-packed road. We come out to the end, no cars around, no people around, and we take out our snowshoes and we take off through the woods where we are making first tracks. So the idea from Last Tracks comes from that somebody wants somebody to die here on this snowshoe trip. But as my husband and I are trekking along, he says, you know, this would be a good way to kill somebody. Nobody would ever find the body here. And I said, what a great idea. That's how the story started. And I'll show you a couple of pictures. This is the story Last Tracks was actually based on a real lake called Malinia Lake, but I did not use that name because I didn't want to be caught if I had anything incorrect in terms of describing the area. This is it in the winter. You usually don't see, hey Maria,
hi.
You usually don't see open water, but you can certainly see the mountains and it's really beautiful. This is a picture on the other end in the summer. It is equally beautiful. It's crowds of tourists in the summer, and you can take boats out onto the lake. In the winter, There's no one up there. Now the couple, they end up going snowshoeing. They get out there through a trail. They get to the edge. There's a lake there, which is frozen. But some snow has blown away, so you can walk out a little bit. And the husband, Andy, says he wants her to take her snowshoes off and get on the lake so he can take a picture. And he says, she says, how do we know it's safe? What if the ice breaks, cracks? Deanna worried aloud, and she started taking off the snowshoes. She cast the snowshoes into his outstretched hand. Trust me, it's safe. We're at 6,000 feet, and the lake has been frozen since October. Trust me were two words Deanna hated. In her experience, every time she heard those two words, something bad happened. Muttering the words, trust me, she ventured out a few feet, avoiding the deep snow, and carefully stepped between the drifts onto the frozen lake. Hurry up, take the picture before the ice cracks, she joked. You're in the shadows. Move out past the tree shadows. Okay, okay. Deanna grunted and trudged farther out onto the lake, stopping at the edge of the long shadows cast by the afternoon sun. She was still nervous about venturing out onto the ice. It certainly looked frozen, but she didn't know enough about it to know whether it would be as solid in the middle of the lake as around the edges. She did remember headline stories every winter of an ice-up snowmobile or car falling through the ice in Maine or off the shore of Lake Erie. Even ice fishermen who supposedly knew something about ice became the object of ridicule when they fell through. She shook off her nerves, reminding herself she wasn't as heavy as a car or snowmobile, and tried to relax for the camera. After the photo was taken, she turned around slowly and looked at the view with wonder. For a moment, time stood still. She felt as tiny as a grain of sand standing on the frozen lake, staring up at the mountaintops. They had to come back in the summer, in spite of the crowds. She sighed with contentment and marveled they were the only two people there at that moment. So they continue on the trip, or on the snowshoe. They put their snowshoes back on, and they're going to head back to get back to the car before dark. She puts her snowshoe on, and it's damaged. She can't walk. Well, you cannot get through, you know, several feet of snow if you don't have snowshoes on. You just can't. So her husband says, you stay here. I can move fast. I'll get back to the car. I'll go get help. So he leaves her there. So he, you know, time goes on. It gets dark. She gets cold. He's not. He hasn't come back. So she has to assume maybe something's happened to him. So she has to start making plans for how to get through the night. But when she'd been out there, he was taking the picture. She glanced up and she saw a ledge that thought there might have been a cave up there, and she remembered that. So she makes her way there. She scrambles up this rock and finds this cave. Before she went on this trip, she took a hunter education class, which is something I had to do in order for research for the book. And they give you a lot of information about how to survive. And of course, one of the tips, if you're going to go out on a long trek and there's any risk you might be injured or might get stuck for the night, you need to know how to build a fire. So what would be the most logical thing you would take if you were going out? What would you put in your pocket?
Right.
Matches, a lighter, right. Well, at the hunter education class, we learned another trick. And they told them to always take in a little bag steel wool, and then take a battery. And if you rub the two of them together, goodness. Can everybody see that?
Yeah, I hope that. Yeah.
Isn't that something? So you can start a fire that way. So anyway, she clambers up into this cave and is relieved that does not appear to be a bear hibernating in there. And she gets in and figures this is a great place to hide for the night. And she's surprised to find an old trash bag and a metal box. And in the trash bag is obviously somebody's stash for spending the night there. She opens the metal box, and there's pencils and artwork and stuff. And she thinks, oh, shoot, this must be for an artist. But then she digs a little deeper, and she finds the steel wool and the lighter. And she starts laughing because she knows right away how to use them. So she's a little bit relieved because she only had a small box of matches. So that makes that a little bit easier. As the night goes on, she used one snowshoe as a tool, and the damaged one, she lugged both of them with her. up into the cave, and the night goes on. She sat up and reached for the damaged snowshoe. Holding it close to the fire, she looked at the slit in the webbing and ran her fingers along the edges. A clean cut, no frayed edges. Andy would have blamed it on cheap imported snowshoes, or imported rubber, sorry. She hadn't stepped on anything that would have sliced it. The snow was so deep, she couldn't have sheared the rubber webbing on a rock. She couldn't and didn't want to find the words to ask if it was possible Andy had sliced it with his knife. What was more depressing, the danger she was in or the fact that she was starting to suspect her husband of deliberately leaving her to survive or not survive? A night in the wilderness with a damaged snowshoe and a malfunctioning SIM card. So I bring the snowshoes because most of you think of snowshoes with the lacing. Mm-hmm. Well, those haven't been around for a long time. And they're also easier to fix, but the only place you're going to find them is hanging on a wall in a barn. But these, I've had these for over 20 years, and you can see, that nothing's ever happened to them. I've gone in deep snow, I've gone in heavy snow, all around Virginia and all sorts of places, and they're pretty indestructible, really. So if there's a sharp cut, it's almost, you pretty much know it must have been deliberate. And the other thing you wear if you go out snowshoeing is you strap these on over a pair of boots, and you do need gaiters, just like for cross-country skiing, because if you don't, every step you take, you're going to kick snow up into your socks and your boots. But that's all you need. It's a real safe way to get around slippery conditions because of the cleats on the back, so I think everybody should have a pair of snowshoes. Even around here, when we get a few inches, you can just go out anywhere in the woods. It's a lot of fun. So the night goes on, and the other thing you have to worry about is food, and you start getting really hungry. It was just after 3 p.m. by the time she had a big warm fire going. She hovered over it, rotating her body to let all parts soak in the warmth. She tried to imagine the smell of a steak sizzling on the fire. Instead, the hissing sound around her ears gave off the smell of musty mittens drying out. The memory of Sergeant Myers telling the class, that was the hunter education class, about her squeamishness on her first squirrel hunt made Deanna smile. She had tried to hide her oh yuck look when two of the women talked about the quickest way to skin a squirrel. Right now, she was hungry enough to eat a squirrel raw. The memory of Kimberly's culinary recommendation on how to cook a squirrel made her smile. Daddy brought a lemon and a bag of herbs with him. She had proceeded to explain how her dad prepared and fried the squirrel at their campsite. There were no herbs and lemons around, but Deanna was hungry enough to just put it on the stick she was using to poke the fire and roast it. Kimberly had concluded her enthusiastic description of a squirrel dinner with, "Tastes like just like chicken." At this point, Deanna decided squirrel, whatever it tasted like, would be fine eating. Now, luckily, what she had taken along with her was jerky. And I've got buffalo jerky here because in the book it says she eats buffalo jerky. Now, my friends that just came in, Sue, she actually makes her own jerky, but I didn't think I had to ask her to make some. But I forgot to bring toothpicks. But if anybody would like to try these, I'll pass that around. So night goes on. She's had a little bit of jerky to eat. She decided to drink a little water and go down one more time before settling in for the night. She would wait until sunset, climb down, and set off the second and last flare. She had found some flares in that box also. She curled up in the sleeping bag to rest for the 30 minutes before sunset and stared at the sparks in the fire. Dozing off, she dreamed of a warm Virginia night alive with fireflies, armies of miniature lanterns descending through the night sky and landing in the tall grass. Once they landed, the little lights kept moving. She woke up suddenly, shivering. Her hat had fallen off in her fitful sleep. 3 hours had passed. For those who haven't read the book, I hate to give away things that happen, but I picked it. You know she's going to survive, so because it tells you that on the back of the book and in all the descriptions. So someone does help her, and that turns out to be the Canadian Parks Ranger. And she wakes up the next day in this cabin. So here's what she thinks when she gets up. The park ranger asks her if she'd like some breakfast, and she says, great. And then she's thinking, if Andy did make it out of the woods and drove the car to safety, he hadn't gone to the police, and he hadn't come back for her. She shook her head and pulled her hands apart, wrapping them around her arms. He could have reached the car and then driven off the road. Here she was, salivating over the prospect of eggs and bacon, and Andy could be unconscious in a ditch, could be shaking from cold. Here she was, standing close enough to a stove to turn any exposed skin bright red. It couldn't be warm enough for her. Never, ever would anyone hear her complain about Virginia's hot, humid summer days. I do continue to. Deanna closed her eyes and enjoyed the luxury of being able to stand still without shivering and not having to flagellate herself to keep her circulation going. Jim, it's Friday morning, right? She asked. Her watch read 8:30 a.m., but she wanted to make sure she hadn't lost a day. He turned from a pan of sizzling bacon to another pan, flipped an egg, and said, yes, Friday morning. You've been here since last night. While he fixed breakfast, Deanna recounted her tale of snowshoeing gone wrong. When she got to the part about the ice cracking on the lake, she stopped after the words, I heard this vibration and the ice started cracking. She put her hand over her mouth. Jim asked, are you all right? Yes, I'm okay. I mean, I'm alive, right? She laughed with more than a touch of sarcasm. What was that sound I heard? It was terrifying. Because she was out there on the ice when it cracked. He says, it's the temperature swings we get here. During the course of a day, we might have a 20-degree swing. The sound you heard is one of the scariest sounds in the world. Sometimes you can hear it echoing across the lakes at night. That's why I took the long way around the lake to you. I've known too many people who have gone through supposedly frozen ice to even consider crossing a frozen lake. We don't usually have
frozen bodies of water around here.
So that's a good thing. The story goes on, and she ends up back in Virginia. So it's a case of she's trying to track down the guy that left her to die, and there's a lot of reasons for that, and he's also trying to stop her so that she'll stop looking for him. I don't want to tell everything, but because I might ruin stuff for you, but here they are sitting at a gas station, and she's with Jack, one of the men that's helping her, at a gas station. She's standing out of the car with a gun in her hand. She was attracting frightened stares. The sound of approaching police sirens warned her she was probably the reason for the sirens. Someone would have called the police to report a woman screaming and holding a gun. A state trooper pulled into the parking lot, lights flashing. Everyone moves as far away as they could get and still watch the action. By then, she had placed the unloaded gun back in its case and explained to Jack that she was sure Andy had been in the parking lot. Oh, no, she thought as the state trooper approached, not another Detective Wheeler. The reflective sunglasses made it impossible to see his eyes. The combination of the black leather boots and his hand resting on his gun as he walked toward her made her realize she was in real trouble. Are you the woman with the gun? He asked. Deanna told the state trooper she purchased the gun from the owner of Deer Ranch. She was on the way there for shooting lessons. At the mention of Deer Ranch, the reflective sunglasses came off. He said, you know Snooki? The next second, he was on the phone to Snooki. Whatever Snooki said kept the trooper from handcuffing her and hauling her off to the local jail. He said, Snooki's on his way. He'll be here in 10 minutes. When he arrived, Snooki confirmed Deanna was not a crazed murderer. He managed to convince the state trooper that she was in fear of her life. Snooki was so convincing in her defense that a chill ran through her as he described the danger she was in. Curly, Snooki said, and Deanna wanted to cover her eyes and cry, realizing her fate was being discussed by two men with nicknames. She had the gun in the case as required by law. She purchased it because she's in danger. Her husband has already tried to kill her once. She's trying to do this right. She was on her way to see me today with this gentleman for shooting lessons. That gun wasn't even loaded. Deanna cringed when he told Curly to call Detective Jackson. Now Kate would find out she was not working away inside the Watergate. Snooki, Curly interrupted, you know I could confiscate that gun and write her up for brandishing a weapon. Yeah, I know, Curly, but you know me. Haven't I always been straight with you? He stopped until Curly reluctantly nodded. Well, you know the law. If she's in fear of her life, she has a right to defend herself. If this lady says that was her ex, then that was her ex. Let them follow me to my place and let's forget about this. Deanna held her breath while Curly decided. He removed his stiff, broad-brimmed gray hat and wiped his brow. So much for descriptive nicknames. Curly was bald. He put his hat back in place, hitched up his pants decisively, and stared her down. Deanna decided this was not the time to win a staring contest. She let her eyes and head drop down. Ma'am, he said, did you get a license plate number? She had no answer. His next question was, make and color of the car? I'm sorry, she said. She meant it with all her heart. It was some kind of sedan. Tan or beige, but I don't know the make. I was too upset to pay attention.
So, just for the record, I did take, when I took the hunter education class and I ended up buying a gun, I bought my gun from a man named Snooky at the John Deere store in Culpeper. Now, that gentleman has since passed away. But the point is that when you try to write a book, and Pete, you asked at the beginning, where'd you get the idea? Well, from snowshoeing, and I love to read thrillers and mysteries, and in reading a lot of them, some of them I would just stop reading and give away because they were so bad, and I thought, oh, shoot, I could do better than this. And boy, was that a mistake, because first of all, if you don't know anything about law enforcement and you're not an attorney, you have to do a lot of research, and then if you try to write about survival, you have to do more research. So I took a hunter education class, I took a women's outdoor survival class, and asked a lot of questions. I hit up a poor retired policeman from Greene County, and he was very kind and answered all of my questions, because you want to make sure you get it right. One of the common questions or complaints the police have is that when they see stories on TV or they read books, half the time they get the facts wrong, and that's not what would actually happen. And Nan here has written a book, and she said one of the biggest challenges was all the research that you have to do. So there's a lot that goes into it, and once I got going, I had a lot more respect for even those books I didn't like. Because it isn't easy. I guess we could open up for questions now, then. And you're welcome to take a look. I've got a lot of... books. Here's some books with pictures of Jasper and Alberta here. Here's a book if you're worried about walking around outside and what sort of an animal you can tell from their scat. And here's pictures that show the different scat. We live here in Charlottesville at Ashcroft by Pantops, and we've got bears running around up there. And we saw evidence of the scat first, but then last week the bear actually ran right in front of the back window when I was out there. So... you don't have to go out west to see bears.
Right.
And it's sort of interesting if you do have anything in your backyard to see what it looks like. If you want to wash away the taste of the jerky, there's some peanut butter cups here. Does anybody have any questions?
Can you still practice?
I don't have a question, but just a comment. I love thrillers.
Oh, good.
And I drive my brother to distraction because I'll get halfway through it, and then I'll decide who's guilty, and I will go to the end of the book. And people are smart now. They don't tell you the last page. It's further in.
Yeah.
And then I'll go back and see how the story unfolds. So I really like... Yeah. Going to the back again. And he thinks I'm nuts, but it works for me.
Right. Well, if it's a book that I don't enjoy the writing, sometimes I do that. I just skip to the back and I skip over a lot of it because...
Oh, no, I go back.
You go back.
Because it's a good book. Yeah.
Good. Well, you should come to the Tuesday Thriller group here.
I think I might.
You should, yeah. It's really a good group. Yeah. Any other questions? Somebody else has something?
Is this a picture of the...
Yeah, this I based this story on Lake Malinia, which is a real lake, but I did not name the lake in the book in case I didn't get facts right or something. And so this is a picture of it in the summer. It's really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And you can kayak or take a little boat out there. And then this is it in the winter. So it's a truly beautiful place. Yeah.
It sounds like you've got the story moving through all sorts of different settings all
over. That's right.
Why did you choose to move it around so many different locations?
I guess just to keep it interesting. What I found out when I first wrote it, and I went to a writer's week at the University in West Virginia, they had editors there, and they looked at it, and they said, well, this is good, we like it, but it's somewhere between a cozy and a thriller. They said, we think you should go toward thriller, get rid of a lot of the cutesy stuff. So I took the cutesy stuff out. And then the other thing is, in the thriller, you're supposed to keep everything moving, as opposed to in a mystery where, like you said, you're trying to figure out who done it. But in a thriller, you have to keep action going all the time. And so I guess
part of that, I was trying to move it around and any ideas would just pop into my head. And I'm from the Midwest, and which never gets any respect or coverage. And it's referred to as flyover territory, I think, by a lot of people. Yeah. And so I wanted to give the Midwest a part in it, even though I guess you could say the bad guy came from the Midwest, which some of my classmates in Indiana picked up on, but they were still glad to see Indiana described. So it was kind of fun, and we find in the Mystery Thriller group at the library, we sort of like to have books that move around and take place in different parts of the world. So we'll read books that take place in Iceland or South Africa, different parts of Europe, all over, and it sort of is an education for us when we travel. So I figured people might enjoy moving to different locations.
I thought that part was realistic because, yes, it's fiction. Okay?
Yes.
You can make it be whatever you want, but when people are going away on vacation, they don't have unlimited resources to stay there. They
yeah.
go back home
right.
to deal with whatever the problem is, and that's what she wound up doing. It's been a few months since I read it, and I can't
yeah.
remember the exact details of how you work that transition for her going back home, but
yeah.
it was like, well, yeah. That,
well, of course you're going to go home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And so that, and things continuing there makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah,
so,
okay. Okay,
I like that.
How long did it take you from your idea in writing to finish your book with all the research you had to do?
Well, it took a long time. First, I wrote just a short story, and it was about a moose encounter. And out in Jasper, which I did have a moose encounter out there, okay? And it was just a short story, and it was meant to be funny, and the close of the short story, she eats a chocolate moose head, right? But then I had, someone came to a writer's group I was in, and they said that it's easy to write short stories, which it is not. Those are difficult, too, but he said it's much harder to write a book, and I thought, well, yeah, I'll write a book. So it started from that, but then as it went along and I got, you know, editor help and it was supposed to be a thriller, they didn't like the moose encounter at the beginning. It was funny. You know, they wanted to start further in the story, so a lot of stuff got cut. But it basically, I would say, total writing time took about 3 years. Yeah, because, you know, as you do stuff, you would... it would change also, and you make one change to correct something and then you have to make other changes. So I have so much respect now for anybody that writes anything because it's really not easy.
How did you and the library hook up to do this reading today, this program?
Well,
did you approach them or they approach you?
No, Marcia, who was our sergeant major for the Mystery and Thriller group, I think she mentioned to Evan that she enjoyed my book. And so that's what it came from. Yeah.
How do you decide on the names of your characters?
Oh, that's a good question. I just sort of pull them out of the air, and some of them are real people, and in fact, I forgot to take some of the real people's names out of here. One of them is my friend's niece, and after the book was done, I said, oh God, tell Meredith I'm really sorry, but she died. And I forgot to take her name out. But for the most part, I changed them. And I picked the name Andy because he's the bad guy, but I thought Andy sounds like a friendly, nice person, so I thought that would be a good name for a bad
guy.
Sure,
Andy Taylor.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I guess you have a vision in your head of what the character looks like, and then you pick a name.
Find a name.
But then, you know, there's connections. There's overlap of things that happen in your life. And one night at 9:30, I get this phone call, and this guy says, Susie McKenna? He said, yeah. He said, this is Sonny Weiland. Oh, my God. This is from Indiana. This was my first boyfriend in high school.
Oh, no.
His dad was the sheriff in this little town I grew up in Knox, Indiana. So unconsciously, I didn't even thought about it. I picked his name for Sonny, the retired sheriff in Indiana. And, you know, he said, you used my name. So you never know where the names are going to come from. You try not to pick somebody you know too well. But the character Cindy, I know a couple of people named Cindy, and they both think that I picked their name.
Now, if Candy shows up, you're in trouble.
I'm in trouble. Her name is Candy.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how you spell it.
Just spell it wrong, okay?
Just spell it wrong, okay?
Yes, sir. So when you started the process of making your story longer,
yeah,
did you say to yourself, I'm going to make this a thriller?
Well, yeah, thriller slash mystery. I wasn't sure how much action I had to put in here to distinguish between the two, but yes. So I was trying to concoct scenarios where I could keep the story and the chase going.
So initially you weren't sure that this is how much of a line is there between thrillers and mysteries? Because it seems like if you know the villain already, then some of Conan Doyle's stories, I think like The Scarlet Letter,
uh-huh,
would be classed as thrillers today rather than
mystery. Yeah. Well, so technically, I guess according to the definition in a thriller, as opposed to a mystery, some of the murders have not yet occurred. Now, so that's the case in this book. The murders have not yet occurred when it starts. But once the story goes along, you find out that, in fact, there have been several murders before that come to light and have not been solved. So in this one, there are murders that take place during the book and some in the past. In a lot of the mysteries that we read, a murder takes place, and then the whole thrill of reading the book is trying to figure out who done it. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're
a little bit okay.
That was a good definition.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Do you still practice with your sidearm?
Not very much, but
you're going to own one. You
I know.
Know how to
I
use
know.
It.
Yeah, I should.
So are you mentally putting together another book, or is this going to be a one and done? Or?
Yeah, no, I finished another book, and now but people have asked for a sequel to this. I guess they like some of the characters, so I do have a start on a sequel. Yeah, I finished one, which is sort of timely, and it's about the alt-right. And so it's not a real cheerful book, and it's more of a novel than it is a thriller. But the next one I've started is I started with a golf incident, and I've got several of my friends here who play golf, and I've got a dead body on the golf course.
Oh, no.
And we can pick somebody we don't like from
the
dead.
Oh, please. Oh, let me think about that.
For the dead body. So
I'm going to play golf with a whole different perspective.
Sure. Yeah, there is a shooting scene in the book where she learns to shoot, but I won't go into all that.
Good.
Do you stay with the same publisher when you go to another book? Or, I mean, can they reject that book?
Oh, sure, they can reject anything. Yeah, now this one I used Archway Publishing, and they are owned by Simon & Schuster, but it's still considered self-published or independently published. But they can turn your book down, and they can, if it hasn't been properly edited. So that's one of the reasons I went with them. I wanted to make sure I had a professional edit job, because a lot of the books that are published on Amazon Create Space, no real editor has ever looked at them, and then they're full of typos and errors and things.
How do you find an editor?
Well, that's hard. An editor. That's a little bit easier than today. If you want to get published, you have to find an agent first, and then the agent lines up the publisher. And I did have an agent, but then I chose to not work with that person for a variety of reasons. So I
killed them on the golf
course. Killed them on the golf course, right? But it's tough. It's really tough to find an agent, and you send off a lot of requests for them to look at it, and you get nice letters back saying thank you, but no thanks. So it's hard to say what it takes to get somebody. But I just this book actually, the James River Writers in Richmond, they have a really active, large writers group, and before my final draft, I submitted to their best unpublished novel contest, and it made it to the semifinals.
And that gave me motivation to continue because they said it needs some editing work. But they liked it, and they gave me a lot of good suggestions, which, you know, led to, I think, a better product in the end. And I went, they had a conference a couple of weekends ago, and I went to that conference, and I won a session with a woman who is a professional editor. So she's reading my second book right now, and I'll be curious to see what she thinks. Yeah, so... Yeah, does anybody here like to write? Or have they thought about writing? Well, other than that, yeah. And Monica writes poetry. She has a poetry book out, which is very good. Yeah. Anybody else thought about giving it a stab?
Well, it would vary, you know, book to book. But so, and you give and take between the editor. Or did you do, like, draft, redrafting or changing 2-3 times?
Oh, many times. Yeah.
Continuous back
and forth. And there's a gentleman here in town. His name is Kenny Murata. And he... teaches English at UVA, and I thank him in the book because I give him a draft, he'd look at it, but Kenny is a very gentle soul, and his criticisms are really, you take it in a positive way, and he'll say, you know, you need to flesh this character out more, or I wasn't sure what was happening. You know, he gives you guidance without stomping all over it. And so I went through a few iterations. He's laughing. Why are you laughing?
It's very good. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
So you need to find somebody like that, I guess. And then it helps to read out loud. My husband is here, and he's been he's been subjected to everything because I say, "You have a few minutes, and then I'll read it." And he's a very careful, slow reader, and that's what you also need: somebody that will read and say, "No, you've said that once before," or "This isn't consistent," you know. So it's a long process. And you wonder, you know, when you think about authors like in the old days, you know, that would produce tremendous amounts of books, how in the world they did that when they didn't have a computer? And it's just amazing. They must have been, they really thought carefully before they put a word down on paper. Now we get kind of sloppy, I think. We just go so fast.
Because you can always cut and paste.
You can always cut and paste, right. Any other questions? Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All for coming.
Thank you.
All right, well, that was a lot of fun. I definitely enjoyed getting to hear from local author Susie McKenna, and I hope that you enjoyed it as well. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Thank you for tuning in. If you haven't already done it, please subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. Consider rating and reviewing. That helps us to reach more people in the community who might like to hear these kinds of programs. A big thank you, as always, to the Friends of the Library, without whose generous support the programs that we record and the podcast itself would not be possible. If you'd like to learn more about the Friends of the Library or become a friend, you can find out more at jmrlfriends.org. That's it for us today, so thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.